Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I want to welcome back our guest co-host, Dr. Jamila Battle.
Welcome.
You know, it's good to have you back. We have a really good show today. We're going to be talking with Dr. Jonathan Weiler, Director of Undergraduate Studies and Professor in the University of North Carolina's Curriculum of Global Studies, about his new book, Prius or Pickup? How the Answers to Four Simple Questions Explain America's Great Divide. I'm a little that title is provocative, and I know that this will be an interesting conversation.
This is definitely going to be interesting given what's occurring in our politics today.
We also have some great research that matters. Let's dive right in about health. And this very first one is about how stress could impair memory and thinking skills.
Intuitively, that just makes sense. I certainly feel like I don't remember things as well when I'm under a lot of stress.
This was actually some researchers who were really interested in the blood levels of a hormone called cortisol, which is oftentimes called the stress hormone, and looking at giving this test for memory and what they call abstract reasoning. You might give a parable and see if people understand it, their visual perception and the intention, to over 2,000 people who didn't have dementia, and then looked at the blood levels of cortisol and MRI examinations to look at associations. What sort of things did they see?
They controlled for important things like age and sex and education, BMI, blood pressure, and they found that compared with people with just average levels of the cortisol to those with higher levels, they had lower scores on these cognitive tests that you described. And also the women had reduced brain volume.
When they had high cortisol?
Yes.
Right. So their hypothesis that the cortisol levels could be associated with impaired reasoning and maybe some MRI functions, and then levels of cortisol certainly are provocative, not cause and effect.
Not cause and effect. You definitely need more study to find causal effects there. But I certainly think that this really suggests that higher cortisol levels can be significant with cognitive and brain function.
Well, we all often know that stress may be related to depression. It could cause anxiety. All of these things that we know contribute to impaired thinking skills. So why should we see stress be different, really? I mean, some stress is probably almost inherent to life.
Right.
Right. But these very high levels may be as associated with high cortisol.
Exactly. That's toxic stress.
Yeah, toxic stress isn't good. Okay, that's our very first conclusion. Seems reasonable to me. We're going to go out on a limb. Okay, our next research has to do with the HPV vaccine, or the human papillomavirus, which is used to prevent cervical cancer and genital cancer in both men and women in transmission, and whether or not those who have mandated state laws to get vaccinated with this, are kids more active sexually? Why is that an important question?
Well, I think because parents believe that if HPV vaccination is given, somehow that will plant the seed that the child is either going to start sex or have early sex or more promiscuity or sex without condoms. And so there's this perception, you know, that the HPV vaccination will actually cause high-risk sexual behaviors.
Well, this research doesn't really support that, because they looked at these states that had these laws, and then they looked at almost a million adolescents and their reports of sexual activity, and did not find greater sexual activity in those states that had these laws compared to those that they didn't. Now, that's, again, doesn't totally disprove this, but there's no evidence that it shows this.
Exactly. And in fact, it even says here, across all states, the proportion of teens who said that they were sexually active decreased slightly after 2007, when the HPV vaccine first became widely available.
And there are other things that were good in there. I mean, 97% of the sexually active teens used condoms when they had sex. One in four reported having sex in the 3 months of the survey, which could be less than one might expect or more than one might expect, depending on one's expectations. I thought it might be more, so I thought that was actually good that it was not as much. And clearly, the HPV vaccination saves lives. And I've had lots of conversations with parents, and it's not so easy to say we're going to give a vaccine to save something that may not happen for 20, 30, 40 years. I get that, and I get the fact that you don't want to say, oh, my child would know to use condoms all the time and would never be at risk. But you know what? We don't always know everything that our kids are doing. I'm just saying.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, let's talk about our next research that matters. This is such an important research that matters, and it really has to do with conversion therapy to change LGBT, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, adolescence, sexual orientation. And I must say, I find this research important, disturbing, important, and disturbing.
I would agree. It sounds like in this research, they actually show that change efforts were linked to higher levels of depression and suicidal behaviors, lower self-esteem, lower life satisfaction.
Yeah, major outcomes for these kids. And this was actually published in the Journal of Homosexuality. We're going to ask our friends in the Health Sciences Library to actually put this link up there. I think it's an important study for people to look at and really come to their own understanding. What they were looking at is these conversion therapy, trying to change the orientation of adolescents who've come out as LGBT. And the change could occur from the parents, it could occur from a therapist, or could occur from a religious leader, or maybe all three.
Right.
And it has to kind of start probably with the parent, but it frequently will be a parent and a religious leader, a parent and a therapist, or all three. And as you said, they were really looking at some important outcomes like rates of attempted suicide. And so those who did not have a conversion experience, the parents had probably accepted this. 22% of them did attempt to commit suicide, which is like astronomically high. Mm-hmm. But if they had been tried to change his sexual orientation, suicide attempts were 48%. And if it were change of conversion therapy by more than one person, like a therapist and religious leaders and parents, it was 63%.
Right.
OMG. And then depression, same thing, 16% if there wasn't a conversion attempt. That doubled to 33% if the parents had tried it, and 52% if both parents and others had tried changing it. This tells me that, I mean, I've known, healthcare provider, that there is no evidence that sexual orientation can be subject to conversion therapy, that this is genetically programmed and determined and environmental is not amenable to this. And yet, there are those who continue to do this, but yet you see these type of outcomes. I suspect if we said any other behavioral intervention that doubled the suicide rates, we would abandon it as doctors because our first obligation is to do no harm.
That's right. And I guess I could see parents and religious leaders wanting to, I guess, try to change identity if they don't understand, and maybe they're motivated by these attempts to protect their children. But the data shows that this causes harm.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm sure we'll have more discussions. Maybe we'll even do a show on this particular issue. I think it's an important issue. I think that's going to conclude all the time we have for the research that matters. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Jonathan Weiler, Director of Undergraduate Studies and Professor in the University of North Carolina's Curriculum of Global Studies, about his new book, Prius or Pickup, How the Answers to Four Simple Questions Explain America's Great Divide. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Jamila Battle. We'll be right back.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Jamila Battle. Today on Conversations, we're talking with best-selling author Dr. Jonathan Weiler, Director of Undergraduate Studies and Professor in the University of North Carolina's Curriculum of Global Studies, about a new book, a provocative book, called Prius or Pickup? How the Answers to Four Simple Questions Explain America's Great Divide. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Weiler.
Thanks so much for having me.
You know, it's really interesting. We've known each other for a long time, and we perhaps share some political views. But when you move into really trying to explain the world order, it's really quite fascinating. We're going to have a long discussion about that today. But first, we'd like to know a little bit more about you. How did you get interested in political science? Did you just wake up one day when you were in college and said, I'm going to be writing books on political science when I get older?
Well, actually, Adam, I grew up in a very political household, a left-wing Jewish household in New York City, and politics were just sort of the air we breathed when I was growing up, which was in the 1970s in New York City. So I was always interested in politics. And when I went to the University of Michigan as an undergraduate, I majored in political science, and I knew more or less that political science would be the field of study I'd want to pursue in graduate school, which I did at UNC Chapel Hill. I got my PhD here in political science. Though I actually, my field of study as a graduate student and in my early academic career was actually Russia, Russian politics, human rights in Russia. My first book was called Human Rights in Russia. People would often joke with me that must have been a really short book. But I became interested in political psychology out of interest, and also because a very good friend of mine, Mark Hetherington, my co-author, and I just started having conversations actually after the 2000 election and the Florida recount and the incredible intensity and anger that accompanied that recount and the feeling that each side had that the other side was just sort of an alien force. And we started talking about where that all was coming from. And, you know, I have to say that all seems really cutesy now, because if polarization seemed bad in 2000, it was child's play in lots of ways compared to what we're dealing with in 2018. But so that's kind of where I came to in terms of writing about this subject.
Nice.
And thinking of kind of compared to 2000 and where we are now, is it a different landscape?
Yeah, I mean, in a lot of ways, yes, it is a different landscape. It's worth saying that the kind of polarization that we see today is decades in the making. It did not come out of nowhere. Trump himself certainly did not come out of nowhere. If you go back to the 1960s and the Nixon campaign of 1968 and the so-called Southern Strategy and this increasing focus on cultural issues, race, family structure, gender, sexuality, that increasingly became central to our politics over the subsequent several decades, all of that really provided the foundation for what we see today. But it has all been intensified and supercharged in recent years. And then you throw Trump on top of all of that, and you've got a particularly potent combination.
So when we talk about questions, broad questions that can help divide and understand really what's happening, how did you think about a model for developing those questions? And maybe give us some feel for what those questions are that you find to be really overriding principles to helping understand macro, maybe micro, you know, what's happening.
Yeah. So those four questions that are referred to in our subtitle, those four simple questions, as we say, that explain America's great divide, are questions about the qualities that people think children should have. And those questions, I should note, were not developed by us. They've been out there in one form or another for several decades. They've been refined over time. And in the form that we use them, psychologists, social scientists, political scientists have been using them for the last 25 years. And so what researchers do is they ask people, do you think it's more important for kids to be curious or to have good manners? Do you think it's more important for them to be independent or have respect respect for elders. And let me say that
the answer to both of those is yes.
Well, right. So this is what I was about to say, Adam, because when you show people those pairs of attributes, the overwhelming response is, well, yes, I'd really like my kid to be curious. And when I take them out to eat, I don't want them to be a disgusting slob. So, yes, I'd like them to have good manners, too. The interesting thing is what happens when you force people to choose and prioritize. And it turns out that when people do choose and prioritize, their answers are extraordinarily revealing about people's politics, about how they feel about gay rights, race, gender, the role of women in the family, what party they vote for, how they feel about how we should fight the war on terror. We've sometimes referred to them as a Rosetta Stone for understanding American politics because they have this incredible ability to explain the division that we're now all experience.
So I'm thinking of one question about what type of car. You know, do you want a Prius or a pickup?
Right.
And I've always wanted a pickup. But I bought the Prius.
Right.
And the reason I bought the Prius is, you know, a pickup has a V8 engine. It's not environmentally sensitive. And it feels like I'm being selfish.
Right.
You're just nodding your head.
Yes, that's right.
you could have predicted that, right?
Yeah, well, so right. There are certain tendencies that tell us a lot. You know, we've joked before that we could have called the book Prius or Pickup. We could have called it Kale or Iceberg Lettuce. Mm. We could have called it Dunkin' versus Starbucks. Mm-hmm. You know, all of these sort of consumer preferences that we have, I think what's interesting about those, and those I should note are separate from these four parenting questions that are really at the heart of our sort of examination of the American political divide. But all these consumer preferences now, what's interesting about them is that we don't really need to know somebody's politics anymore to know their politics, right? We see what kind of car they drive. We hear them talk about what kind of food they're interested in. And we just kind of know where they stand politically because of all these non-political identities that people have.
Well, Facebook knows that.
Well, Facebook definitely knows that.
Oh,
but even without Facebook, we kind of know it too. You know, and we make these really automatic snap judgments about people now based on their non-political preferences because we're pretty sure.
Give us an example. One that could impact some health, like nutrition or food or something.
Right. So the Prius is not a health per se, but it is a good example. And it's a good example in part because for the reasons you said, Adam, that people who drive Priuses tend to do so for these, you know, environmentally friendly reasons. And they feel like that's a selfish kind of choice. But we also, you know, whether people are vegetarians, you know, I think tells us a lot about what kind of politics they have. And I think for some similar reasons that a lot of people who make the choice not to eat meat don't do so because they dislike meat, but because they feel like whether it's animal rights or environment that they ought to be doing that. And again, I think people make very clear judgments if they know somebody's vegetarian or vegan that they know their politics and they can make all kinds of other assumptions about that person just knowing that dietary preference.
Is it because we've somehow become more emotional and therefore we're making decisions based on those emotions as opposed to facts?
Well, so this is a really good and important question. This is important to understand. So the way we describe people's orientation to the world is we talk about worldview. Right? These basic ideas about hierarchy and whether the world is a big, beautiful, diverse place or whether it's a place full of danger that we need to be wary of and mistrustful and careful. Those kinds of, let's say, personality orientations, those have always existed, right? We've always been different in some of those basic ways. What's interesting about politics now is the degree to which those personality orientations and our political identities have aligned themselves, right? So it used to be 20, 25 years ago, plenty of we use these terms fluid and fixed, right? So we've got fluid folks are the more liberal, open to diversity and so forth and so on, and the fixed are more stick with what you know, play things close to the vest, respect tradition and hierarchy. 20, 25 years ago, plenty of Democrats were fixed, plenty of Republicans were fluid. And for all sorts of reasons, there's been a sorting process so that a lot of the fluids who used to be in the Republican Party left for the Democratic Party, and a lot of the fixeds that used to be in the Democratic Party left to the Republican Party. And now there's this alignment, this very clear alignment between personality and party that we argue has made the political divide much more potent. Because it's not about issues anymore. It's about something much deeper and more visceral.
Well, we're going to need to take a short break. But when we return, we're going to continue really a fascinating conversation with Dr. Jonathan Weiler, Director of Undergraduate Studies and Professor at the University of North Carolina's Curriculum of Global Studies, about his new book, Prius or Pickup, How the Answers to Four Simple Questions Explain America's Great Divide. We'll be right back with your health. Stay with us.
Your health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we've been talking with Dr. Jonathan Weiler, Director of Undergraduate Studies and Professor at the University of North Carolina, about his new book, Prius or Pickup, How the Answers to Four Simple Questions Explain America's Great Divide. And right before the break, Dr. Weiler, you were really, I think, helping us understand better this divide and that how understanding something as simple as a philosophy about food or a philosophy about consumer goods really can be illuminating towards the whole political view and kind of move us in a direction. And I wonder if we were to look at some issues in healthcare, just how this starts to play out and ones that we see frequently in the news that seems to have some really strong views, let's say vaccination and immunizations. Does that fall into this conversation?
Yeah. So it's a really interesting question. One of the results of the election last Tuesday night seemed to be a pretty strong endorsement in lots of ways for key elements of Obamacare, for example, like Medicaid expansion, which did very well even in states that are that otherwise voted Republican, like in Utah and Nebraska. And I think that suggests the possibility that when it comes to certain, let's say, universal experiences like health and making sure people are cared for, we could find something like a consensus. The less optimistic spin on that, though, is that in an era where everything is politicized, whether it's the National Football League or health or food, then partisans start to take sides. You know, in other contexts, I don't think Obamacare would have been nearly as controversial as it's been since its inception, you know, about 8 years ago. And I think the reason it has been so controversial has to do with political partisanship, not with people's underlying ideas about whether they think providing basic health care to people is a good idea.
I would agree with that, actually. And I see it taking us, I guess I'm pessimistic, down a very dangerous territory and wonder, is there a bridge, you know, to this polarization that maybe could take us out of dangerous waters?
I guess I'm of two minds about this. On the one hand, right now, I'm not optimistic. I think the state of play is so divisive and so angry right now, and it's all reinforcing itself. You know, it's not just that we're deeply divided, we're closely divided. And the closeness and the deepness of the division just seem to reinforce each other and make us feel like wins for the other side. It's not just, oh, too bad, we'll live to fight another day. It feels like a catastrophe. Mm-hmm. So that's on the one hand. On the other hand, things always change. Nothing ever stays one way forever. And related to that, too, you know, I do think there's a very important role that leaders play in this process, which itself has a positive and a negative component to it. The negative component is that we are all much more swayable and persuadable by our leaders. We all like to think that as democratic citizens, we think for ourselves and we come to our own conclusions. But the truth is, in a lot of ways, and I'm not just talking about Republicans or Democrats, I'm talking about people in general, in a lot of ways, we are like sheep. And we do kind of go along and listen to those who we respect and believe in. On the other hand, if leaders talk more responsibly, that could help change and shift the conversation. I mean, let's just take John Kasich, a very conservative Republican, outgoing governor of Ohio. I don't personally like his politics, but John Kasich favored Medicaid expansion in Ohio, for example. He did not see that as an ideological or partisan issue. And if our leaders were more willing to sort of talk in terms of the general good, I think it could have a positive impact on just the way we talk about politics in general.
I think about in the examination room when patients are there, we might sometimes joke about the elections, particularly if we know each other's political views, but most frequently we don't talk about politics, my politics or my patient's politics. And we trust each other. And so trust seems so important. And then some of my research really has been about trust in the FDA and trust in the CDC, Centers for Disease Control and Food and Drug Administration, have very high credibility and trust among the American public, both among Democrats and Republicans. Doctors have pretty high trust. Mm-hmm. The pharmaceutical reps do not. And so is some of this that we can overcome and this bridge by really focusing on trust and how we build trust between our institutions? Because right now, people do not trust Congress.
Yeah. And in general, people don't trust politicians at all, right? I think trust is critical. And I think one of the realities of the political climate we're in now is that there's just an assumption that everybody on the other side is acting in bad faith. That's just – it's almost a given. You know, it's interesting. My co-author, Mark, has done this very interesting research related to this idea of sort of trusting institutions about what happens when you tell people that the military believes that climate change is a significant threat. And the result of some of that research shows that a lot of people, including conservatives who might otherwise be skeptical of climate change, are more likely to believe it precisely because they trust the military as an institution and because they believe the military is interested in their well-being and their welfare. Therefore, they're willing to give it a second look on the issue of climate change that where if a wonky academic said the same thing, because they already mistrust academics, they would just not feel the same way. Mm. So I think there's something to be said for leveraging institutions we do trust to build some sense of a kind of a notion of the social good that we can all share to some degree.
You know, you've published other books. And I know you wrote a book on divorce, a love story. Tell us a little bit about maybe that book and some of your other writing.
Well, so that book in particular, Divorce, a Love Story, it is worth noting my co-author on that book was in fact my ex-wife.
Was she an ex-wife before you started?
Yeah. Well, it's actually because we got divorced that we were then able to write a book together. So my former wife, Ann Mankins, who remains, you know, very dear to me and is my co-parent to our 21-year-old daughter, Lillian. With that book, I'll just say this quickly. We began thinking about that when Lillian was a teenager, and people would say, you guys have a really good divorce. Maybe you should write about it. We were like, yeah, we've done a pretty good job. Let's do that. And then parenting got more difficult as Lillian advanced through her teenage years. And we were like, well, rather than this book being kind of a victory lap, we're going to turn it into a more honest exploration of this sort of ups and downs and challenges of that process. And I guess I would say more generally, Adam, thinking about writing, I also do lots lots of writing about the relationship between sports and politics, for example. I'm very interested in thinking about how we relate to the world around us when we're being sort of honest and vulnerable, and we're not just trying to put sort of a nice gloss on everything, but just to be honest, but to be honest in a way that other people can relate to and can understand, and maybe they can just get something out of that process of self-awareness that I think the writing process at its best brings out in people.
Well, we want to thank you. We've been talking with Dr. Jonathan Weiler, Director of Undergraduate Studies and Professor in the University of North Carolina, about his new book. And we'll put it up on our website and encourage our listeners to get a copy.
Wherever books are sold, as they like to say.
Wherever books are sold.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much for being our guest today.
Thanks so much for having me.
We'll take a short break, but then coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Jamil Battle. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Calls segment of our show today, Jamil and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about listener health questions and concerns. If a listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, send their comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question.
Our mother recently died of cancer, but she had been undergoing treatments for several years prior to that. Our doctor said that hospice would be a good idea at the right time, and both he and we would know when that time came. Recently, she was in and out of the hospital three times, taking up almost an entire month. So by the third visit, our doctor said that he thought the time had come. Over the next 2 weeks, she quit eating and was able to die at home without pain. How often does end-of-life care work like this?
Well, I'd like to say it works like that all the time, but it doesn't work like that all the time. And first off, we're sorry about the loss and happy, though, that the way it works seemed to really work well for you.
Certainly, hospice is a very comfortable way to transition, and it's also an honorable way when someone's been suffering with a condition with a poor prognosis and poor quality of life for such a long time.
You know, it's sometimes we think, some people I think are sometimes maybe too quick to think hospice, you know, like, you know, you should be in hospice, and that could be my values, but it may not be your values. And so you got the provider, and you may have the family maybe wanting it, and the provider maybe pushing to hold on. You could have both not wanting it and both wanting it. And those two extremes, if both don't want it, you seem fine. If both want it, you seem fine. And so being on that same page about what seems best, it's not like they can't do, and it sounds like maybe palliative care was done in advance, so, you know, helping people improve their quality of their life. But knowing when the time is right, we sometimes say the right drug or the right intervention at the right place at the right time, and recognizing that, because you don't want to be faced with, you know, you got 48 hours left for someone to say it's, you know, it's no longer we can do, versus understanding that something changed. The cancer had become more aggressive, and transitioning and improving again the quality of life, but also having control over those decisions. And it sounds like the family made the right decision here.
Yep.
Laura, what's our very next house call?
Recently, my father started taking medication for restless leg syndrome called ReQuip. About 2 weeks later, while his restless leg syndrome seemed to be better, he started talking and acting a little crazy. When we took him in to see the doctor, she said it was because of the medication he'd started. We don't really understand how a medication for restless leg syndrome might cause him to have hallucinations. How would that happen?
Well, first off, restless leg syndrome is just that. People can't get those legs stopping moving, and it's actually not just uncomfortable. It's actually painful for a lot of people, and we always recommend non-pharmacologic interventions. My favorite one is simply stretching. Getting people to do 5 to 10 minutes of stretching or some exercise, stationary bike before they go to sleep actually has dramatic impact on the amount of those muscle twitches. I don't know if you've ever heard of people taking iron, Jamila, as a therapy.
Yep, I have, and that certainly works. But then if those don't help with the legs, then also looking at the medications that they're taking too, because there are classes of medications that can initiate or bring on restless legs.
Yeah, and one of the ones that's used more frequently are medicines called dopamine agonists. Dopamine, that chemical in the blood that when it's released, sometimes we feel better. So we sometimes try to increase the dopamine levels for people who have depression. Sometimes some of the medications can block the dopamine. And there's medicines that are called dopamine agonists that stimulate these receptors for dopamine, but they stay in the blood for a longer period of time. And for some reason, I don't really understand fully why, but it appears to have an impact on restless legs, these couple of these medications. So one of them is called Requip. I think there's another one, Promaxin or something. Mm-hmm.
Mirapex,
yeah. Primixapol and Ronitral. We'll call them Mirapex Requip. But they do stimulate, and this is a brain chemical. So if one thinks about anything that stimulates a brain chemical, while it may have a therapeutic effect, stimulating brain chemicals is sometimes playing with fire. And they can cause hallucinations. That's not an infrequent. Matter of fact, people have Parkinson's disease who sometimes take some of these similar medications can develop hallucinations.
That's right. It's just sometimes it's too much of a good thing, right? So it's all about balance. And certainly in a depressed brain, when there's deficient amount of dopamine and we're restoring balance, you know, we certainly don't see as much of the hallucinations there. But if in a brain that maybe is not depressed or has deficient dopamine and now we're kind of pushing it over the threshold, certainly we could get those psychotic symptoms, which are the hallucinations, or maybe increased impulsivity even.
Yeah, like people become gamblers, or
yes,
they do sexual promiscuity when they haven't ever done that before. And
right,
it's like, whoa, what's going on here? So these are potent medicines, and we encourage you to really talk with your doctor about these sorts of medicine before starting. There may be good indications for doing them, but you got to be followed really closely.
That's right.
Yeah. Good luck. And the good news is it does go back to normal when these medicines are stopped.
Well, that is great news.
So, and then they can just do some do that stretching, and then all of a sudden maybe that'll be better. Laura, what's our very next house call?
I'm curious if a person with type 2 diabetes will just automatically end up on insulin. I'm trying to do everything I can lifestyle-wise, but should I just accept that that's what's going to happen?
No. Okay, that's the short answer. Next question, no. Jamila, this is a good question and not one that we should take lightly.
It's a great question. You start out with lifestyle modifications, you know, eating a healthy diet, exercise, and certainly if medications are then needed, there's lots of options, lots of different classes for medication, but it doesn't mean that you're a failure if insulin is needed. Sometimes the insulin, though there, it's just not working very well.
Or you might run out of insulin. Your body may quit producing it. And there's a test sometimes called a C-peptide you can measure. And if that test is low, you don't have any insulin left in your body and you will need insulin.
That's right.
And you're right. There are some people who they need the insulin. A lot of people really do. Matter of fact, if you're insulin-dependent diabetic, you need insulin or else you actually would die. And a lot of our what we call our type 1 diabetics are just like that. They really – their pancreas is no longer producing insulin. A lot of the type 2 diabetics, we don't think as much as insulin-dependent, still may need insulin. The problem is in those patients, you give them insulin, sometimes it stimulates weight gain too, and they're trying to lose weight. So we're really trying to get them off. Some of the newer medicines can help, but they're sometimes really expensive. Could be $1,000 or more a month. Mm-hmm. Insulin can be cheap. Not an easy answer.
It's not.
You'd like to see this patient, wouldn't you?
I would, actually.
And you'd like to reassure them that they perhaps can get off insulin if they're on it, and maybe if they get on it, that's not for life.
And that's a really good point, Adam. You know, just because maybe you needed it, it doesn't mean that it is for life. And checking the C-peptide to see if, even if you're a type 2 diabetic, you know, do you have an insulin deficiency and a need for the insulin as well?
Yeah. Well, That'll conclude our house calls today, and we want to thank all of our listeners today. We hope you've enjoyed our guests and our research and the house calls. And if any listener wants to send an issue they'd like us to discuss on an upcoming show, they can send it to yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or our health app. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare, for their sponsorship. Our guest co-host, Dr. Mila Battle, and our guest today, Dr. Jonathan Weiler. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Battle.
And we look forward to talking to you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.